decision we saw in Florida. But in North Carolina, we just won a decision that actually will allow a large number of formerly incarcerated people to vote, even if they have not finished paying their monetary debt to society. What we are seeing is in our Constitution, the 15th Amendment, it says no one can deny or abridge the right to vote. What we're seeing is an attempt to both deny and abridge the right to vote in real time. And that's why we have to fight back. That's why we have to know the law. That's why we can't allow these poll watchers he's talking about sending in to question people, to intimidate us. That's why we can't let precincts close. That's why people have to engage early voting. That's why we need to know our legal rights. And that's one of the things tonight. We have two law firms that have fought for against voter suppression. Forward Justice, led by attorney Caitlin Swain, and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, led by Sherilyn Eiffel. They're going to be laying out what your power is to protect your vote. And we have to stay in and be steadfast, because nobody would be fighting this hard to keep people from voting if it was not rooted in
Finally,
fear.
Reverend Barber, we just have 20 seconds. Tomorrow, Tuesday, September 15th, it's the 57th anniversary of the bombing of the Birmingham church that killed the four little girls in 1963. In these last 20 seconds, your thoughts on what we should know today.
We'll be there, Richard Trumpkin and I, with the AFL-CIO, and myself and the pastor laying a wreath and then speaking to the nation that just like labor and faith came together in Birmingham to transform the nation even after their deaths and before, we have to do the same thing.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio wants to know what you care about this election season. We want to ask our listeners one simple question. What do you think candidates should be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know by filling out our Citizens Agenda survey, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa prepaid gift card. The responses we get from our community will inform our reporting on the November election. We want our coverage to serve our community, and we need your help to make it happen. If you would like to participate and be entered to win $50, open your web browser and type bit.ly/KBOO survey into the address line. Again, that's bit.ly/KBOO survey. And thanks.
We don't get pool again.
And now, your daily volunteer produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, historic wildfires across the West Coast continue to rage, including some near the Portland area. The number of cases of COVID-19 in Oregon and across the country continue to grow, and Patriot Prayers' Joey Gibson is suing the Multnomah County District Attorney. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 14th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. Wildfires across Oregon are still blazing, though vigilant firefighting efforts and improving weather conditions are providing some optimism for residents. Officials removed Level 1 Get Ready orders for parts of western and northern Clackamas County on Sunday evening, as the two large fires that have been threatening the greater Portland area are posing a lesser threat than initially feared. As of Monday morning, the Riverside Fire and the Beachy or Santium Fire have not merged, as fire crews have begun to work the perimeter of the blazes, keeping the two fires roughly a mile apart. Currently, 36 wildfires remain active, with grim statistics of 12 confirmed deaths and over 934,000 acres impacted. The majority of the ongoing fires are in the westernmost part of the state, along the Cascade Mountain Range. Much of the state remains under an air quality alert, while the heavy smoke has combined with fog, reducing temperatures and lowering the fire risk for many communities. Emergency personnel said an estimated 500,000 people statewide still remain under some level of evacuation order, but as upcoming weather conditions improve, those orders are likely to lessen. Jackson County was issued a red flag warning on Sunday evening, though the high winds prompting the alert had not materialized by Monday afternoon, which eased concerns. The Holiday Farm fire is still burning in Lane County at a just 5% containment. It's still threatening more than 23,000 structures, according to fire experts. In southern Oregon, the Alameda fire is now reported to be 70% contained, which is good news after the blaze brought devastation to over 600 homes and nearly 6,000 acres. The Echo Mountain Complex fire burning near Lincoln City is 25% contained, lessening evacuation orders and allowing some residents to return to their homes. East of Roseburg, the Archie Creek fire is 10% contained, as Sunday evening weather trends helped to decrease the blaze's spread. Despite rain predictions and more favorable wind conditions, fire experts are advising people to remain on alert, as wildfire activity is unpredictable and can change quickly. Over the weekend, Portland's air quality continued to worsen due to ongoing wildfires across the West Coast. Parts of the city reached a staggering 516 on the air quality index as of Sunday evening, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Other areas throughout the state showed very high AQI numbers as well, including Roseburg with 579, Salem with 562, Eugene at 511, Bend at 490, and Vancouver, Washington clocking in at 459, all as of early evening on Sunday. To put those numbers in perspective, an AQI number of 50 or below represents good air quality. Any number higher than 300 represents hazardous air quality, and numbers approaching 500 or above are considered to be dangerous levels of pollution. The data comes from IQAir.com, which is a website that ranks international levels of air quality. It showed the top four most polluted cities in the world as of noon on Monday, and they were all from North America's West Coast, with Vancouver, BC at the top of the list, followed by Portland, Seattle, and San Francisco. The West Coast has been permeated with extremely smoky air as unprecedented fires blaze throughout California, Oregon, and Washington, with reports of western smoky air affecting air quality in states as far away as Michigan. Weather officials say air quality could improve by Monday evening into Tuesday as rain is predicted, though the National Weather Service is warning residents that smoky air could persist until later this week. Health experts advise people to stay indoors as much as possible and to limit strenuous activity, as current air conditions pose several health risks, including headaches, runny noses, scratchy throats, coughing, and nosebleed. One family story of evacuating during the Estacada fires highlights how communities can come together to help each other during difficult times. Here's that story. Andrew Voss and his family live in Estacada, where they farm goats. Voss originally hails from California, so preparing for wildfires isn't necessarily new. But last Monday, the rapid escalation of the Riverside fire meant Voss's family and their 80 goats had to find somewhere to go, and fast.
The big concern for us is that the place that we were aware of that was traditionally where you would evacuate to with livestock in the case of wildfire was in Canby at the Clackamas Fairgrounds. Problem was that by the time that we were at a level two, Molalla was at a level three. And so a lot of the roadways between us and Canby were running next to or through level three evacuation areas. And so given the distance and the fact that we can only trailer about 15 goats at a time or 20 goats at a time, we had real reservations about running the goats out to Canby because we didn't know if we'd have enough time.
Instead, they tried to go to Sandy High School as their evacuation spot, since the athletic fields could potentially hold their goats. That didn't work out, but it did get Voss connected to a man named Gary.
We received a call from a gentleman named Gary who basically said, you know, I just received a call saying that you guys were looking for evacuation assistance from your farm with some goats. I have a horse trailer I would be happy to, you know, bring in and assist you. Where are you trying to evacuate to? And I said, well, we don't know yet. We're still looking for a place to go. And he said, okay, hold up, give me a few minutes. I'll make some calls for you and see what I can come up with. And about half an hour later, he called back and said, okay, I've got you a place. I'll be there in 45 minutes with a truck to help you out. And, you know, I was a little floored because I've never spoken to Gary before, and I had no idea who he was.
With Gary's help, the family transported their goats and necessary belongings to a horse farm in Sandy.
So we got everybody loaded up and just started driving towards Sandy. And the whole time, you know, I'm thinking, you know, I'm following somebody who I don't know. My goats are in his trailer. We don't know where we're going. We don't know if the house is in trouble. We get out to this field in an old cattle farm, and the gentleman who owns the place welcomes us and says, yeah, I've pulled up some water for you. He's got a big flatbed truck with a 300-gallon water container on it. He says, you've got power over here. You've got water over here. Use whatever you need for this space. Let us know if we can help you. You know, none of these people who are offering us their home, their help, you know, risking themselves and their transportation to get us out of a dangerous fire zone, we didn't know these people 4 days ago. So I think it's just an amazing testament to how well, I guess for that lack of a better word, you know, country folk take care of each other. And I'm floored and incredibly grateful for the experience.
Voss was overwhelmed by the generosity of these once strangers, and he says,
I swear I'm going to do something amazing for him as soon as I have the opportunity to do so.
Now that the goats and the family have been safely evacuated from the fires, Voss counsels others to take fire warnings seriously.
I guess the best advice I would have is take it seriously and move early. If you can find a way to get yourself out early, that would be great. You know, get out, don't panic, but don't wait till the last minute either. And there are always concerns about what's going to happen to your house after you're gone, and the truth is, it's just stuff. Even if we come back home and somebody's ransacked our house, we still have gotten the most important stuff off the property, which is our family and our livestock, and, you know, the farm is just stuff. And, you know, I think that it's better to remember that, you know, stuff can be replaced and living things really can't.
Up-to-date information on your fire risk and evacuation recommendations can be found online at wildfire.oregon.gov. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Althea Billings. On Sunday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 185 new confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total number of known cases up to 29,337. Oregon health officials also reported 5 new deaths, raising the state's total number of deaths due to the virus up to 509. Multnomah County had the highest number of new cases on Sunday with 38, followed by Washington County with 33 and Marion County with 27 cases. Governor Kate Brown wrote on Twitter on Sunday, quote, "It's hard to believe this can all happen at once, but in addition to the wildfire crisis, COVID-19 is still very much with us. This weekend, Oregon passed the grim milestone of 500 COVID deaths. Protect your neighbors by wearing a face covering, keeping distance, and washing hands," end quote. Deaths and new diagnoses have been falling in Oregon for 5 straight weeks. New diagnoses are down 5% from the previous week, and a smaller percentage of the people who are being tested are coming back with a positive result. People in their 20s continue to be the most likely to contract COVID-19, while those older than 80 make up nearly half of all Oregon deaths from the virus. Nationally, as of Monday morning, more than 6.5 million people in the United States have been infected with the novel coronavirus. At least 194,000 people have died. Over the past week, there have been an average of about 35,000 cases per day, a decrease of 17% from the average 2 weeks earlier. Case numbers remain persistently high across much of the country, although the number of new cases have dropped considerably since late July, when the U.S. average was well over 60,000 new cases per day. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 29 million people in nearly every country. As of Monday afternoon, at least 924,000 people have died across the world. Patriot Prayer leader Joey Gibson is suing Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt for pursuing riot charges stemming from a May 2019 brawl in Portland. Gibson, along with his affiliate Russell Schultz, filed a 28-page complaint against Schmidt and a deputy district attorney on Friday, saying that the officials, quote, engaged in bad faith, selective, and retaliatory intent for pursuing the charges against them. Gibson and Schultz are among six men who were accused of inciting a riot on May Day in 2019 between right-wing Patriot Prayer and left-leaning Antifa groups outside the now-defunct Portland establishment Cider Riot. Two of the six pleaded guilty and were sentenced in January, while Gibson and Schultz have pled not guilty and are slated for trials on October 26th. Their lawyers, D. Angus Lee and James Buchall, who's the chair of the Multnomah County Republican Party, they allege that Schmidt and his deputy DA pursued prosecution in violation of the office's own written policy. The policy in question was newly implemented by Schmidt. It dropped many low-level charges against protesters who have participated in racial justice demonstrations since May. Schmidt announced last month that his office would not pursue riot charges against most of the hundreds of people who have been arrested at Portland protests in recent months. When repeatedly asked to drop the riot charges facing Gibson and Schultz, a response from the DA's office said the charges would not be dismissed and that the office's new policy is not retroactive. Buchall said he and the other attorney, Lee, plan to file for a temporary restraining order next week. They told OPB, quote, "This is just one example of a real pervasive misuse of governmental authority in Portland to disadvantage politically disfavored points of view." Buchall has also said that Patriot Prayer is, quote, "promoting free speech, patriotism, and conservative Christian values." Patriot Prayer is known for its often violent clashes with opponents, with rallies staged in progressive cities like Portland and often attended by fellow far-right hate group, the Proud Boys. When asked about the Gibson case and Friday's lawsuit, DA office spokesman Brent Weisberg declined to comment, noting that it is a matter currently pending before the court. You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth look at possible police reform in the city of Portland with City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. At 6, we'll hear Labor Radio, then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 63 degrees. Tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high of 79. The National Weather Service has also extended the air quality advisory for the Portland area through Thursday. Today in history, in 1814, Francis Scott Key writes a poem called The Defense of Fort McHenry. The poem would later be set to music, and in 1931 became the U.S. national anthem, The Star-Spangled Banner. The quote of the day is from American poet and activist Nikki Giovanni, who said, quote, "If now isn't a good time for truth, I don't see when we'll get to it." As wildfires ravage the West Coast, Trump and Democrats continue to differ on the issue of climate change. With that story and more, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
I live in Oregon, and the state of Oregon is on fire right now because of climate change, and literally on fire.
That's Jean Flemma with the Ocean Defense Initiative, which is calling on Congress to take meaningful steps to combat climate change with the next coronavirus stimulus package. Unprecedented wildfires continue to ravage the western United States, especially Oregon, Washington State, and California. At least 24 people have died, with dozens more missing and hundreds of homes destroyed.
The climate crisis is very real, and we need to address it now.
The White House says President Trump has offered assistance to Oregon and California, where he'll be at an in-person briefing with local and federal fire and emergency officials today. At a Nevada rally over the weekend, Trump thanked first responders and firefighters and gave his own explanation, widely considered inadequate or flat-out wrong.
Please remember the words, very simple. Forest management, please remember. It's about forest management and other things.
In fact, scientists have long warned that wildfires like these and other natural disasters worldwide could result from a failure to stop global temperatures from rising. Washington Governor Jay Inslee told ABC's This Week that Trump's failure to address the role of climate change was, quote, maddening. From South Florida, 18-year-old Jacob Mullen attended last month's virtual Democratic convention as a Bernie Sanders delegate. He's frustrated the Democrats haven't made climate change an even bigger priority.
It's frustrating to hear a lot of talk about, we'll do something about climate change in the platform, but we won't go bold on it. When, you know, down here we're sort of worried about the coastline eroding and going underwater.
Sanders actively supports Biden and stumps for him at virtual town halls. The question is whether Sanders can bring along his supporters, who want Sanders' own more aggressive and costly approach than Biden's climate plan.
The Green New Deal is not too expensive, because the alternative is far, far more dreadful, more destructive, and much more expensive.
And with 50 days until the election, a misstep from the U.S. Postal Service under its new director. The USPS sent the exact same vote-by-mail instructions to voters in all 50 states, misleading because the process differs greatly state to state. Colorado Secretary of State Jenna Griswold argued that the resulting confusion amounts to, quote, an attempt at voter suppression, unquote. A federal judge in Colorado stopped the mailing there. Colorado has successfully sent ballots to all registered voters for years. California is doing it for the first time. Their Deputy Secretary of State, James Schwab, appreciates the effort to educate voters, but says there are better ways.
You know, election officials weren't consulted. We weren't given a heads up when this was going out. And there could have been room to customize. There's just a lot of misinformation already going on out there, and it's tough to just be on top of that, let alone the USPS sending out a bad mailer.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks to Suzanne Potter from California News Service, and thanks for listening.
The Navajo Nation will take part in a COVID-19 vaccine study. The National Congress of American Indians will host tribal leader roundtables with lawmakers, and Native advocates are urging new environmental policies. With those stories and more, we go to Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation will participate in a COVID-19 vaccine trial. Tribal leaders announced Friday the approval of a Pfizer vaccine trial at clinics on the reservation based on a volunteer basis. The study will be led by John Hopkins Center for American Indian Health. Enrollment will begin in mid-September for people between ages 18 to 85 who have not had a prior COVID-19 infection. Participants will receive two doses of the vaccine and be monitored for a two-year period. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez will host a virtual town hall on September 21st with top U.S. health official Dr. Anthony Fauci to discuss COVID-19 and trial vaccines. As of Sunday, the Navajo Nation reported 8 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the total number of positive cases to 9,977. In the last week, the tribe's data showed fewer numbers of positive cases after months of lockdowns, curfews, and other public health orders. The National Congress of American Indians is hosting virtual tribal leader roundtables this week with members of Congress. The Tribal Unity Impact Days are usually held in Washington, D.C. for tribal leaders to meet with lawmakers and federal officials. The online event is intended for tribal leaders to be able to engage with lawmakers about issues facing Indian country before the end of the current session of Congress. Wednesday afternoon, 7 members of the House are scheduled to take part in discussions. And Thursday afternoon, 5 senators and 3 more representatives are expected to take part in the roundtable. COVID-19, the census, healthcare, housing, education, environmental protections are among issues leaders across Indian country have been addressing in recent months with U.S. lawmakers. Funeral services are planned Friday in North Dakota for Dr. David Gipp, a leader in Native American higher education. Gipp was well known for his more than three decades of work as president of United Tribes Technical College. He was also a community leader and Native rights advocate. Gipp was instrumental in national efforts to establish policies and laws for tribal colleges and universities to gain recognition and support. UTTC became accredited, offering 2- and 4-year programs, technical education, and workforce training under his leadership. Gipp passed away last week at his home, surrounded by family, following a lengthy illness. Native American environmental advocates in New Mexico are urging U.S. lawmakers to strengthen environmental policies. Democratic members of the House Natural Resources Committee are hosting discussions on environmental issues. Last week, they held a virtual environmental justice tour focused on New Mexico. Native advocates say resource extractions have contaminated sacred places and medicines and have had health impacts on people. Leona Morgan, a Navajo grassroots advocate, urged lawmakers to fight proposed nuclear waste storage, continue mine site cleanup, and oppose new resource extractions in the state.
When you're living on stolen land, the colonizer tends to make the rules as they would have them. And so today, some of the impacts we've been living with for decades, for generations actually, and they've only been highlighted because of the recent pandemic. We have not only dealt with the uranium mining, but also coal mining in and around the Navajo Nation, and the contamination to water resources and use of water for extractive industry has really impacted our people.
Legislation was introduced in Congress this summer to seek environmental justice aimed at underserved communities and communities of color. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The search for life outside our planet is moving closer to home. In studies published today, astronomers have announced that they may have found traces of life on Venus. Telescopes aimed at the planet's atmosphere detected the chemical phosphine, or PH3, which may indicate the presence of life. On Earth, phosphine can only be produced by anaerobic microbes, which are organisms that don't use oxygen to function. Such microbes lived on Earth for billions of years, long before oxygen was available in the atmosphere. Today, phosphine is found in worms near deep-sea vents. These worms are known as extremophiles because they live in extreme conditions with no light, oxygen, and very high temperatures and pressures. Phosphine is also found in our intestines. The bacteria that help us digest our food emit the gas. Researchers see the presence of phosphine as evidence of this kind of extreme life on Venus. While optimistic, scientists caution more research into phosphine and its presence on Venus is needed. India's space agency plans to visit Venus in coming years, and NASA may not be far behind. Visiting Venus is difficult as the high temperatures and acidic clouds eat through spacecraft. Such conditions have kept the search for life far from Venus in recent years. It should be said the evidence so far is circumstantial. The study's authors say they, quote, emphasize the detection of PH3 is not robust evidence for life. But one of the scientists working on the study, Dr. William Baines of MIT, told the New York Times, quote, what we've done is rule out all other sources of phosphine gas other than life. You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Samantha Lau, Jason Shermans, and Jacob Prescott. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, and Nadia Ramlagan. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8. It's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with special co-host Tracy Simmons. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we'll hear Stage and Studio. Host Demae Roberts talks with Portland's First Lady of Blues, LaRonda Steele, and features a preview of her newest album, Spirit of Freedom. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews Kristen Kennedy and Aaron Boberg-Dawton of the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art about the 2020 Time-Based Art Festival. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We are currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for an in-depth conversation with City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about police reform.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
So let's talk about Portland.
You have anarchy on one hand, and
police are bracing for violence.
As hundreds of protesters marched peacefully through Portland this week.
Evidence of police shooting indiscriminately in the crowd.
Not racist.
It's not racist.
No. If you look at what's gone on in Portland, those are anarchists. If we didn't take that stand, right now you would have a problem like, you know, they were going to lose Portland.
Every weekend we seem to talk, things are getting worse.
Chaos in Portland over the weekend.
Men wearing masks, camouflage, generic police patches, detaining protesters, putting them into unmarked vans.
What's happening there now?
What happened in Portland over the weekend was not only unlawful and unconstitutional, it was just plain wrong.
Mayor of Portland, Oregon, has compared the scene in his city overnight to urban warfare.
Not good.
Police fired tear gas at protesters in Portland, Oregon.
Protests have shown no sign of slowing down.
Portland seeing yet another week of violence.
Breaking news now, the Oregon State Police have
a large and violent mob.
Hello, my name is Jason Shermans, and I am confused. I sit here recording this audio in my bedroom. I'm not able to go down to KBOO News to record this segment because of coronavirus. I'm also not able to leave my house, or I shouldn't leave my house, because wildfires are raging this weekend and the air is so filled with smoke that it is hazardous to breathe. And as I have just listened to that collage of news clips that I assembled, I am at a complete loss for even what to say and how to start this segment. There's so much going on in the world, and there's so much that is broken. I don't come to you with answers today, but I invite you to join me to try to come up with some solutions for this problem that we are facing in terms of policing in our community here in Portland, Oregon. Like I said, I don't have the answers, but I am searching for someone who does, and I decided that I would talk to the one person in my community that I have met that I think that I thought would have the answer, or at least be able to sort of point me in the right direction. So I called Commissioner Joanne Hardesty.
So let's dive into this. I'm interested in getting a little bit more of your history. I know that you've been very active in community in Oregon and around Portland for decades now, but I'm wondering if you consider your work in the community, activist work.
I consider myself a community organizer. I've always considered myself a community organizer.
As a community organizer, now that you are in government, do you know, right, has that limited your ability to organize the community as a member of the community? Do you feel that has changed?
I think clearly being in an elected position changes the dynamic of the relationships But all the skills I've acquired over the last 30 plus years in engaging community are skills that are absolutely critical to me doing my job successfully. And so, for example, if I'm passing a major public policy issue, I make sure community is engaged in the entire process, right, and helping to figure out what the problem is, what the solution is, and what the policy proposal should be. You know, that's a skill set that I think is unique in government, just in general, because that's not normally how government operates, but it's something I treasure quite a bit. I spent a lot of years banging my head against the wall at City Hall, right, as a community member, as an activist, trying to get changes to take place. And what I realized is that the system in which we operate just really isn't conducive for the most public engagement that we could get. And so with my office, we're committed to engaging people where they are. Before COVID, that meant that quarterly I was having meetings out in various communities because everybody can't make it to City Hall Wednesday morning at 9:30 to provide testimony. And so it's important to me that we create opportunities for the public to participate rather than expecting the public to participate in the very narrow traditional structures that we have in place.
So moving on, I want to talk a little bit about, you were in the Navy, right? How long were you in the Navy for?
4.5 years.
During your experiences, I'm sure you've seen and you experienced how rigorous the training can be. What does that rigorous training and discipline, what does that look like, and does that need to be applied more to our police officers? Is this maybe something that's missing in our police force in terms of training and discipline?
Well, let me just say that the way we train our current law enforcement all over the state, we train them as if they're going to war. So we need to train less for military skill sets, more towards skills that include communication, de-escalation, nonviolent responses to aggression or people with mental health issues. That's why I'm currently serving the governor's task force on the Department of Public Safety Standards and Practices to really look at how do we fundamentally change training from day one, because all law enforcement go to Salem for their first 16 weeks of training. And it's up to individual agencies to decide how much training they have after that. But I have provided training at DPSST, and I have observed training at DPSST. We train police to perceive the community as the enemy, and then we deploy them in communities all over the state with that mindset. A, personally, I don't think we've ever wanted that, but B, I don't think we've also ever had the opportunity to look institutional-wide at how policing happens in our state and our community.
So as we are talking about retraining and reorganizing our police to serve, I'm wondering what are some of the differences and needs that you might perceive between different communities and how they can be served that we should be thinking about right now?
Well, I'm thinking about what does community safety look like? And community safety is not reliant on responses to community social ills. When I look at over the last few years, over 50% of people arrested by Portland police, but for being houseless, would have never been arrested. That is a misuse of our criminal justice system, because poverty is not illegal. And so the fact that we use our jails as a stopgap, that is a misuse of public safety resources. And so we're starting a conversation around what does community safety look like? I can tell you that many of the calls that Portland police get are fear of people. Somebody looks suspicious. Somebody is talking to themselves, walking down the street. The police are not trained social workers. And so what may need a mental health response now gets a police response. What may need a social service response gets a police response. And it is because the police have taught the public to call them for all the social ills. We need to rethink that. So part of rethinking that is the Portland street response. the whole goal of the Portland Street Response is to figure out how do we keep people as safe as possible where they are, right, with the limited resources that we have. I think once that program is up and operational and the community gets to see it in action, they will be thrilled at having a first responder that is not weaponized. That's what, when I did community surveys, when I interviewed houseless people, when we did focus groups, it was overwhelmingly that people need to be safe where they are, especially if they have nowhere else to go. And so police should never, ever be called unless there is a weapon involved or some real crime is taking place. And so we have to retrain the public. We have to retrain our new police force. And we have to create other first responders since we haven't changed that system since the early 1900s. And the only change we made then was paying first responders as compared to them being all volunteers.
That covers pretty well how we protect communities in general in Portland. But yeah. Specifically, are there ways, or let me ask this question, are the ways that we need to train police how not to react? Are police, for example, if they're called out to, someone calls in a suspicious person call in Northeast Portland versus someone calls a suspicious person in Northwest Portland, are they reacting differently to those two calls in negative ways?
That's a very good question. I would even go a step further and say, what is the description given of the unwanted person in Northwest? Because what we know is that Black people are stopped much more often in areas that they don't live in. So I would suspect a suspicious person who's African American in Northwest would get a more aggressive police response than a Black person in East Portland. The areas in the city of Portland where Black people traditionally are not in high numbers are areas with the highest arrest rates of Black people. And so my analysis says that, you know, it's because somebody has assumed you don't belong in that neighborhood.
When a police officer arrives, let's say in a Black neighborhood versus a white neighborhood, are there differences in the way that community is going to react? Are there differences in the way the Black community and the white community react to a police presence in their neighborhood? And how does that affect how the police should be responding when they arrive in that neighborhood or should be comporting themselves?
Well, I think everything depends on what officer responds and what their personality type is. I have seen officers respond to Black people who are smiling and who are relaxed and who are engaged in conversation. And I've also seen people be stopped and the police have their hands on their weapons before the window is even rolled down. Everything depends on that officer's perception of the call that they're on.
Right.
I also know that when community members have also been trained to make the call sound as scary as possible to get a quicker police response. For example, people will make calls and say, oh, somebody put up this camp across the street from my house, and they're doing drugs in it. Oh, I see a weapon, right? And so what they know is that the more excited and more dangerous they make it appear, the more likely there is they will get a police response. But let me also say that when we have another first responder system, the 911 call takers will be asking questions like, do you see a weapon? Do you see people involved in brutal, are they beating each other up, right? Like, what is going on at the scene? So we are, at this time, retraining 911 operators on some very specific protocol that will help us divert calls that shouldn't go to police in the first place.
So currently, and I'm sure extending into the coming months, we have all these protests nightly in downtown Portland. How should protesters expressing their civil right to free speech, how should they be handling the police? How should they be interacting with the police? How should they be handling being dealt with by the police when the police start to try to remove them?
I continue to be extremely frustrated with the fact of why are we sending 30 riot police out to guard a Portland Police Union office building. As you know, I am not the police commissioner. even though I have asked the police bureau be put in my portfolio many times, it has not happened. But I can say that it is not helping the current state of policing, the abuse that I see happening by a very small number of protesters against the police and a large number of police against peaceful protesters. It's totally, the response by police has consistently been over the top based on activities that they say a small number of protesters are involved in. The police are supposedly pretty well trained, which means if they don't know by now, the handful of protesters who are setting fires, who are attempting to assault the police, then they are not effective detectives and investigators. But if they can't figure that out by now. The fact that the response to a small number of people throwing whatever they throw at the police, whether it's water bottles or rocks, the fact that the response is to tear gas entire neighborhoods is way, way, way over the top. And so, again, my frustration is if I was in charge of police, they would be prohibited from showing up at protests. They would, and they would be allowed to show up in riot gear anywhere. So, you know, I remember leaving my house for a protest, and I had a gas mask and other tools so that if, when I was tear gassed, I would be able to help myself recover. And I thought to myself, what is wrong with the fact that people have to actually gear up in protective gear to go and exercise their free speech rights? That should never be acceptable anywhere, and especially not in Portland, which is known for protesting everything, right? We protest a lot. But this new level of police violence and protest is something that I have not seen in my time, my 30 years in Portland. And the narrative about the police being under attack, I find just really appalling. Well, what if people burn down the building? So a building burns down. Do you, would you rather tear gas 10,000 people or rebuild a building? The police are supposed to protect and serve people, not buildings, not property, but people. I think the police would have made a lot of friends when the federal occupying force came in and they had protected Portlanders, because that's what they actually had vowed to do. Instead, they joined forces with the federal goons that showed up and terrorized Portland. I mean, terrorized people. If I did that, if the Black Lives Matter movement did that, we would all be in jail. We have a lot of work to do to get to the police force that I imagine we should have and we can have, but we're nowhere close to that yet. And I have no confidence in the current leadership that we will get there under their leadership.
I agree with you, and I'm sure this is a long road that we have ahead of us. I'm sure for this generation that's out there in the streets right now, it'll be continuing for a lifetime and beyond, to not only fix the police but make sure it stays fixed. If you were to be put in charge of the Portland police tomorrow, what would be the top three differences between you and Ted Wheeler?
Oh my gosh. Well, the first is they would be prohibited from showing up at protests. The police would be prohibited from showing up at protests. The police would be prohibited from using any munitions, tear gas, any projectiles that they would use as weapons against the community. And they would learn de-escalation skills immediately, because it is clear to me that when police show up at a protest today, they are not showing up to de-escalate anything. And the other thing is any officer that did not intervene when people showed up in our community with weapons and were beating up and assaulting people, if they did not intervene, they'd be fired immediately. Don't tell me that, oh, you didn't have enough people to actually, when you finally do have a threat, people with weapons that are attacking community members, you don't have enough police officers to do your job. That's a problem. So you said three, I ended up with four.
That's good. That's a good list. Currently, are the Portland police democratically accountable?
No, they've not been accountable to anyone for quite some time, which is why they have the kind of power that they have. What the police have been able to do for generations has been to sell fear to white homeowners this is what crime looks like. This is where crime is taking place. Call your city council and get us more money. And that has been an effective strategy for policing in this country for 100+ years. I mean, I've been doing police accountability for 30 years in the city of Portland. And I can tell you, I can count on one hand the number of times Portland Police Bureau did not get the financial resources that they demanded from the city council. And they are still the only bureau that consistently blows their budget up with overtime with no accountability. So, no, I don't believe they are accountable to anyone at the moment. And I think not only I, but I think a majority of Portlanders are starting to have that same perspective. That's why my ballot measure that will actually create the first truly independent police oversight board with the ability to compel testimony, with a budget that is equal to 5% of Portland Police Bureau's budget, with the ability to implement discipline that cannot be overruled or overturned in arbitration. That is going to be on the November ballot. We will have lots of community conversations over the next 9 weeks about whether or not this approach makes sense. But I can tell you that the community has been asking for this for the 30 years I've been doing police accountability and have never gotten even close to it. So the fact that a unanimous city council vote sent it to the voters tells me that we're in a place where real transformational change can take place.
So this police accountability board, is that where you dream that the buck will ultimately stop when it comes to police accountability, or will it still be, will it be in the mayor's, or will it be the police union?
No, this board, when it is ultimately seated and implemented, will have all the powers I just described. We still have to make some changes to state law, and so this is a part of the bigger reform efforts around reimagining community safety. So the accountability board by itself is not a fix. Reimagining community safety by itself isn't a fix, but all these pieces working cooperatively together are part of actually what's going to help us get the best reform as soon as possible and hold police accountable for the outcomes the community say they want.
So the police union contract, which is going to be renegotiated in January, if you personally, if you knew that you only had the political capital to be able to change one thing about it, what would be that one thing that you would want to renegotiate?
Well, you know, unfortunately, over the years, there is so much egregious stuff in the Portland police contract that no other public employee has. I think a union contract should only be about working conditions, period. If I had a magic wand, it would be about working conditions, it would be about worker protections. We would not have all the crazy stuff like, currently there's a clause in the police union contract that says elected officials cannot say anything about a law enforcement officer that may bring embarrassment to them. Now, how the heck do I know what embarrasses 900 individual people? Been in the contract so long that no one remembers what year it was added is very problematic. There are just so many things like that that, again, are not in any other public employee's contract. Most public employees' contracts are about working conditions and worker safety, period. And that's what the police union contract should be. It should not be a fail-safe to not hold them accountable for behavior that's inappropriate. And that's what it has become.
After the Portland Police Union contract has been negotiated, do you think that it should be subject to referendum?
You mean a vote by the people?
That's right.
I think that that would just open up a can of worms about all public employees' contracts, right? I am a union through and through, and I value unions, and I don't want to do anything politically that undermines the value of being represented by union. But my question would be, there's only one public employee segment that has life and death decision making. And the question is, should they be part of a union at all? And if so, what should that union benefit look like? You are a public employee, so it means it certainly should cover working conditions, worker safety, salary, et cetera. But it should not exceed any protections that any other public employee has. Because, again, it is the only workforce paid for with taxpayer dollars and retirements paid for by homeowner dollars that has life and death decision-making power. I think that puts them in a place that is radically different than it puts any other public employee. I'm certainly evaluating every aspect of policing at this moment because I think for too long, we just haven't asked basic questions. And this is one of those. Why do we have a police union? What is the purpose of a police union? And if we can't articulate what the purpose of the union is, then the next question is, well, why do we have a police union?
Those are good questions. I think those are questions that Portlanders should really be considering and asking themselves and that our representatives should be thinking about as well.
So I'm going to be helping with that conversation because, again, it's not what I think community safety looks like. It's what the broader community thinks community safety should look like. And so we're going to be having a lot of community conversations over the next few months about what that looks like. Some will lead up to the fall bump. There's still community demand that we cut more money out of the police budget. I'm certainly looking at that now about what I will be proposing as we go into the fall bump process. The reality is that we have to take every opportunity we can to ensure that we are fundamentally changing the institution, not individual officers, but the institution itself. And I have worked under 10 police commissioners and, I think maybe about 15 police chiefs now. And the culture of Portland Police Bureau hasn't changed one ounce in that time, not one. We've had good police chiefs and we've had horribly bad police chiefs. We've had good police commissioners and bad police commissioners. But if you look at the culture of Portland Police Bureau, it hasn't changed at all. We have to fundamentally change the culture and the expectations of what we want from public servants who are sworn to protect and serve us all.
This is not about politics. This is about people's lives, the breath they breathe. We just want to be able to walk down the street and not die.
That was Lynn James, a demonstrator at the 100 Days, 100 Nights sit-in. To finish the segment, I would like to leave you with this thought. These are the words of Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes.
Enough is enough!
Enough is enough!
Each of you that have taken to the street, following George Floyd, following Breonna, following Amar, following those who have been recently killed, you have awakened to a consciousness that we've been there. Others have paid the price. Now we must come together as one and say we will not give up. Until transformation take place.
Yes.
This is our day.
This
is our hour. This is our season. Keep moving. Keep protesting. Keep marching. Keep protesting. This is our season and our time.
So, to update everybody on what happened, I honestly don't know. Everyone was enjoying a hip-hop concert that was put on by organizers. Joanne Hardesty was here. She did an awesome speech. We had a speech from a former Black Panther and Black activist, all sorts of good stuff. And it wasn't even like 5 minutes after, it was supposed to end at 10. And it wasn't 5 minutes overtime until this. They flashbanged and tear gassed the entire park. And now we're kind of just waiting for the tear gas to clear back. So, I mean, this is what happens every night. They'll wait for the gas to clear up, and the protesters will try to take back the park. There it is. There it is. It's easy to spot. So this is the black and dried blood of Donovan Lobella. He was shot by federal officers. He had a really bad skull fracture on the left side of his skull, and then he was kind of bleeding from his eyes and nose, and it was a really disturbing scene for everybody to have to witness. And then, and this is for this to have had to happen so that the whole nation can finally pay attention to what's going on here. Why did a kid have to get shot?
This segment was produced for KBU News by Jason Shermans and Jacob Prescott.
KBU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBU Community Radio's open meeting policy